content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's a Laugh. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. September is nearly upon us, and happens to be National Self-Care Awareness Month. One way to practice self-care is by journaling. Today's stories are examples of how journaling can be extremely relaxing and rewarding, if not downright humorous. From the book, Someone Will Be With You Shortly, Notes from a Perfectly Imperfect Life, written by Lisa Kogan, copyright 2010, the introduction chapter, A Brief History of Me. I suppose you're wondering why I've gathered you all here today. Wait a second, who starts a book like that? Why am I suddenly channeling Agatha Christie? Okay, let's not panic. I can break set. I can shift gears. Maybe something like this. Attention everyone who was ever mean to me at Alice M. Burney Junior High. That means you, Randy Hirschman, Greg Silver, Judy McMahon. I have a word processor now, and I'm not afraid to use it. My name is Lisa Kogan, and I am a 49-year-old single woman who maintains that life is a fragile bit of luck in a world based on chance, that Michelle Obama should be cloned, that Bernie Madoff is the devil, that nobody's grown a decent tomato since 1963. What else? I live in New York City because it's the only place that would take me. I work at O Magazine, which sounds vaguely glamorous, but mostly involves explaining why I can't get tickets to the Oprah Winfrey Show for my podiatrist's cousin. I have spent the best years of my life growing out bangs, searching for a good bra, and wishing I were skinny. Here's a tip for anybody who's wanting to drop a few pounds. Wishing doesn't do it. I don't understand money, football, corporate culture, or the computer I'm typing on. I used to think the world wasn't all that complicated. Just add water and live. But along came AIDS and crystal meth and Rush Limbaugh, and I guess I grew up. Still, I'm deeply nostalgic for that time when you had to walk across a room to change channels, and there was no such thing as a spy satellite capable of spotting the precancerous mole on my inner thigh. Have I left anything out? Let's see. My recent apartment renovation consisted of turning over the sofa cushions, then realizing they looked better the other way. I think every human being deserves a great mattress, a comfortable pair of shoes, and a very smart shrink. The rest is gravy. It's been a long time since I've believed in God, but now that I've put that in print, I'm scared that this God I don't believe in will be mad at me. I get scared a lot. I'm scared the ozone layer is disappearing. I'm scared one of those horrible superstores will be coming soon to a neighborhood near me. I'm scared my parents are getting old. I'm scared my upper arms are getting flabby. I'm scared of lunch meat. And I'm frightened to death of ambivalent men. For a long time, I had a type. Dark, intense, just a touch remote. You know the ones I mean, right? They don't want you, but they want to make good and sure that you want them. At the end of most dates, there'd be a quick peck on the cheek and a simple, "Well, it was nice not getting to know you." I'd actually find myself tempted to reassure the guy that the only thing he'd given away was his name, rank, and serial number. My hope was that this sort of man would fall in love with me. My prayer was that I would get over him. My wish was that we had never laid eyes on each other. Then, just when I decided I could have a fine life as the wickedly funny Wendy Wasserstein used to call a bachelor girl, Johannes appeared with his slow dance eyes and his easy laugh, and ever so gently he crushed my resistance like grapes into Cabernet. Except for a couple of bouts of stomach flu and a few genuinely ugly arguments, there hasn't been a day in nearly 17 years when I haven't wanted to inhale him. But there's a twist. In order to share custody of his son, Johannes lives on another continent. For those of you playing the home game, that would be 8,000 miles, 9 lost luggage situations, and a 6-hour time difference away. We are together roughly every 2 months, making us the envy of most of our married friends. But there's another twist. Her name is Julia Claire Labouche, and she's our 7-year-old daughter. It's a pretty name, don't you think? When I was 6 months pregnant, I dodged the name question with my mother. Gwyneth, I said. Gwyneth? My mother repeated. That's right. I'm going to name your one and only granddaughter Gwyneth. Silence. Is that an actual word? She asked calmly. Yes, I believe it's Welsh for we're not telling people the name we've chosen, I answered with equal calm. Middle name? Attempting nonchalance. Nosferatu. Attempting to preserve privacy of middle name decision. Ava is a nice name, she said, floating a trial balloon. Yes, you've mentioned that, I said, bursting it. I mean, not that you have to go with Ava or anything. Lauren, Emma, Rachel, they all work. Gwyneth, I said. My mother and I go back nearly half a century. It took a lot of time, but I've trained her well. She no longer tells me my paintings hang too low or my hemlines hang too high. She doesn't suggest I get my head out of the clouds or the hair out of my eyes, in exchange for which I refrain from complaining bitterly that she served broiled chicken with a side of bird's-eye frozen green beans virtually every night from 1974 to the bicentennial. She doesn't throw my inability to parallel park at me, and I've quit addressing letters home to the woman who forced me to wear a coat over my Halloween costume. We've managed to forgive each other's frailties, to accept that she's neurotic, and I'm, well, even more neurotic. We understand that I will never wear anything that involves appliqué, and she will never eat anything that involves calories. It's a fairly complex truce, but it generally works for us, and when it doesn't, we moan to our respective shrinks and live to love another day. Others are less fortunate. My friend Robin insists that the next time her mother decides to slip her phone number to a divorced orthodontist from Great Neck, she fully intends to fake her own death. I applaud Robin's creative problem-solving and hereby volunteer to show up at her phony memorial service and repeatedly sob, "Oh, dear God, I guess all that blind dating finally did her in." They say good fences make good neighbors, but I think about the mothers and daughters I know and find myself wondering if the fence must be electrified to keep one's mother from straying into dangerous territory. I kept thinking, will this little person who's currently occupying space in my uterus have to one day line the borders of her heart with razor wire to stop me from chipping away at her choice of laundry detergent and footwear? How do we keep from becoming trespassers in each other's lives? I ask my mother about this, but all she says is that everything will be fine. She insists I'll know what I'm doing, and that if I don't, little Gwyneth Nosferatu will train me. Her vague response annoys me to no end. I'm looking for some hardcore mothering here, for a Campbell's commercial in which we're wearing chunky hand-knit sweaters and sharing deep truths over piping hot bowls of tomato rice soup. I want her to brush my hair and call me Cookie and say the kinds of things you read in Hallmark cards. But that's just not my mother's style. Nor was it her mother's, and for better or for worse, I'm pretty sure it won't be mine either. Instead, I'll leave Julia Clare irritating phone messages suggesting she switch laundry detergents and invest in better shoes. And, because I'm a writer, I'll probably write her all the things that my mother has said to me over the years, if not in word, then in deed. Always try. Always care. Always believe in what you're doing. Always respect yourself. Always know that you are loved. And always remember how happy you made me just by showing up for the big dance. There was a lovely old Warren Zevon song, Mutineer, I think it's called, playing the morning Jules showed up. The song is about rocking the boat and venturing into uncharted territory and bearing witness to a life outside your own. At least, I think that's what it's about. To be honest, I couldn't hear very much above the sound of my own shrieking. I can't take it anymore, I wailed. Really, how much longer? Andre Rebarber, obstetrician extraordinaire, took a quick peek between my flailing legs and deadpanned in a voice that struck me as altogether too serene, given that I had just attempted to kick his face in. Someone will be with you shortly. Story of my life, Doc. Story of my life. Is that your husband? The nurse asked, pointing to Johannes. No, he's my next-door neighbor's husband, and he's crazy in love with me. We're planning to kill her for the insurance money, then buy a villa somewhere in Paraguay, I snarled, and she seemed more or less okay with that. The rest of this story is pretty standard stuff. Johannes and the nurses ordered Yang Chow Lo Mein from the noodle shop on 2nd Avenue. My friend Meg dropped by. Shifts changed. I threw up. Day turned to night. My friend Francesca dropped by. I begged her to grab a chopstick and stab me through the heart. And then, a little after 3 a.m., out came the pink velvet bunny nose, soft butter pecan ice cream cone, floppy peony petal juggle bug baby girl I thought I would never have. 5 days later, Johannes left for Zurich, and I learned that one of the exquisite ironies of being a parent is you get to stay up as late as you want, but all you want is to go to bed early. I also learned how little I know about raising another human being. Here's a tip for anybody out there bringing up baby. Never refer to your vodka and tonic as mommy's pain go bye-bye juice. My, how time flies when I'm doing all the talking. We're already up to the part where I have to end with some simple, albeit clever, albeit straight from the heart phrase, something that says, we're all in this together, something that leaves everybody feeling a little less crazy in a world where something a little less crazy isn't always easy to come by. If only I knew what that was. In addition to Self-Care Awareness Month, September also happens to be National Self-Improvement Month. Lisa Kogan provides an example. The chapter, Julia Has Three Mommies. The love of my life is seeing other women. It started innocently enough, a bite to eat, a stroll through the park, the stuff I never have time for. Then came the private jokes, the pet names, the stolen kisses, the bubble baths. At first, I was crushed. What did these women have that I didn't? Sure, they're gorgeous, but I happen to look very nice in navy. And yes, they're bright, but I scored unbelievably high on the SATs, if you don't count the half with all that math. I told myself it was just a fling, but anyone could tell that wasn't the case. The truth is this. My daughter would follow Miranda Dedushi and Lydia Basha, her two babysitters, to the ends of the earth, and the feeling is more than mutual. For a while, I worried that with Julia's grandparents so far away and Johannes living in Europe for long stretches, Julia's world would be pitifully small. But then along came Miranda and Lydia with their Kosovar lullabies and hair-braiding expertise, and everyone's life took a major turn for the better. They say you can't pick your family, but Jules and I would beg to differ. I spent a lot of time picking caregivers who would cherish and respect my little girl. And, as a result, my little girl fell head over heels for both of them. To be honest, I was afraid she'd prefer them, that because I'm in an office all day, she wouldn't understand I was the one who pulled her through the croup of 2004. The one who managed to score last-minute Dora the Explorer at Radio City Music Hall tickets. The one who taught her to quit putting grapes in her ear. It turns out I needn't have been concerned. She gets it. Kids have a way of figuring this stuff out. They have a primal understanding of who their mother is. But what about the aunts and uncles, the cousins, the brothers and sisters, the people who give you a place in the world and occasionally drop a gummy worm down the back of your T-shirt just for good measure? My Aunt Molly was my grandmother's youngest sister. Maybe Molly and her five siblings were a touch touchy, but they began feeling somewhat less than welcome in Russia. So in 1919, they made their way to Detroit, where my Aunt Molly met and married my Uncle Clyde, a good soul from, I'm not kidding, Tight Fit, Tennessee, and gradually became the family matriarch, which is to say she had a swimming pool in the yard and filled it with cousins every summer. My Aunt Annie would show up with homemade elderberry wine, though my Uncle Izzy preferred to lounge poolside with a tall glass of pickle brine, as my brother and cousins and I looked on in horror. My Uncle Sam quoted Shakespeare, and my Aunt Minnie did needlework. Everybody argued in Yiddish and laughed and snuck scraps of brisket to the dogs hanging out under the picnic table. I loved those days, and I loved those people. But they're all gone now, and Sunday afternoons are for running errands. Julia never did have the pleasure of their company. Still, I know that in years to come, my daughter will remember eating Albanian cabbage pie with Lydia's parents, whom she calls Miss Mommy and Mr. Daddy, and summer evenings at the botanical gardens with Lydia and her sister and brothers. Jules will look back at trips to the Bronx Zoo with Miranda and her husband and realize that, just like her mother, she comes from a great, big, slightly offbeat, seriously funny family who would literally do anything for her. Now, I'd gladly leave it at that, But I can't very well talk about the village it takes to raise Julia without talking about the email that came across my desk yesterday. You see, I mentioned earlier that one of the things people need most is good, reasonably affordable daycare for their kids. I even wrote about it in O Magazine. Here is the response I got from a 30-something Nebraska woman. I have great news for Lisa Kogan. Safe, affordable, fun, warm-hearted daycare for kids does exist. It's called Parents. By actually raising the children we choose to bring into the world, we can give our kids all this and more. Oh, Miss Nebraska, what am I going to do with you? The old me would have simply ignored your great news. If one considers consuming 33 Mint Milano cookies, 2 Snapples, and a 6.6-ounce bag of those little cheddar goldfish, ignoring. But a funny thing happened on the way to turning 49. I took a deep breath and decided I'm much too old and way too tired to keep nursing my adolescent obsession with being loved. The need to please has at long last atrophied and set me free. So, lady, this one's for you. I will resist a smart aleck reply congratulating you on being one of the 11 remaining members of society who can get by on a single income, especially given the forecasts that in the year 2021, when my daughter is ready for college, 4 years at a public institution will run somewhere in the neighborhood of $129,788. And should Julia be smart enough to get into an Ivy League university, we're looking at roughly $279,760. Fortunately, she recently spent the better part of an hour with her little head stuck inside a shoebox, so affording Harvard may not be an issue. But I can't help thinking how incredible it must feel to be unfazed by this prospect. I envy people the ability to stay home with their kids, and there are plenty of days I wish I could be home with my daughter. Miss Nebraska, I, too, am a believer in quality time, and I certainly agree that if you choose to bring a baby into this world, you'd better be prepared to raise it. But I also think that there's more than one way to raise someone. Whether you're doing it alone or with a partner, raising a child may be a labor of love, but as anyone who's ever attempted to talk her daughter out of her American girl doll obsession can tell you, it's still labor. So imagine my weariness when I picked up a magazine in the pediatrician's waiting room touting the virtues of a little something called mommy time. Apparently, the concept involves making a point of getting out there and enjoying a manicure, a movie, a long lunch with an old friend. It's all about making yourself a priority on a regular basis. But here's the thing. I took 42 years for myself, and today my priority is a Barbie backpack carrying 46-pounder with a wobbly tooth and a tendency to wake up every Saturday at 5:45 a.m. Who are these manicured mommies analyzing the latest indie flick over salad nichoise? Are they the same women who do Pilates, run multi-million-dollar corporations, volunteer at nursing homes, and campaign for clean water while having soul-shredding sex with their adoring husbands 4 to 7 times a week and twice on Sundays? Because I don't know any mommies like that. The women I know feel victorious when they manage to buy stamps. We're a motley crew, all in serious need of a haircut and a shot of caffeine. Like the Marines, we do more before 9 o'clock a.m. than most people do in a day. We've seen things in diapers that would send most members of polite society shrieking into the night. There is no surface in our homes that doesn't feel sticky, no cushion on our sofa that hasn't been irrevocably stained. There is no part of our physical beings that hasn't been thrown up on. We live mostly on organic apple juice, chicken nuggets, and the edge. And that, for better or worse, till sleepaway camp do us part, is mommy time. The truth, Miss Nebraska, is that I've never really believed it's possible to have it all. But I know that with a strong support system, i.e. nanny, sitter, grandma, daycare, doorman who doesn't drink, or some combination of the above, you can have a career and a baby if that's what you need or want to have. Will that baby eventually become an adult who requires the service of a very wise shrink because you screwed up? Of course, that's what parents do. Whether we work or stay home, we screw up. We try our darndest, we love our hardest, and then we force them to wear a coat over their Halloween costume, and all hell breaks loose. We want to be better than our parents were, and in certain ways we are better, and in certain ways we're not. But I don't want to fight with you, Miss Nebraska. I've had enough of red state, blue state, your God or mine, tastes great versus less filling. The planet is divided enough, so I'm officially calling for a ceasefire, a moratorium on snarkiness, a touch of tolerance. We are better than this. We are women. We crave potato products. We read witty novels. We notice shoes. We follow our gut. We try to keep men from becoming violent. We shop for bargains. We make sacrifices and quit our jobs to stay home and bring up our babies, or we make sacrifices and go to work and find other smart people to help us keep the plates spinning. It's all good, and it's all problematic, too. There is no right or wrong here, and that, Miss Nebraska, is just the way the cookie, which was not made from scratch because, hey, this is 2010, crumbles. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's a Laugh. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's a Laugh is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.